Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
Hi, I'm Jay from San Diego.
I'm Chase from Seattle.
I'm Jamie from New York City.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy. Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. In 1985, the band Till Tuesday had a hit video on MTV. Their singer, Amy Mann, became kind of famous, but she didn't like it.
It did not suit me very well, I have to say. I mean, I think also Till Tuesday's, you know, big hit Voices Carry was kind of right in the beginning of MTV. And, you know, that was such a novelty that we became really recognizable very, very quickly. And once I kind of had people recognize me, then I was really off the idea because I, you know, just found it kind of uncomfortable.
So she took her career a different way. It's Bullseye. This week, I talked to Amy Mann. She'll explain her transition from an 80s pop star to a solo performer who writes mostly to her own taste.
I'm not that person who's like, I have to make everyone in this place love me, all 10,000 of you. I'm more like, here it is. I hope you like it. If not, then cool.
And then I'll talk to Seth Godin. He's a kind of a creative marketing guy, but not in the sleazy way. He's actually pretty brilliant. And he gives credence, I think, to Amy's point of view.
Finding the intestinal fortitude to do work that some people don't like, to put ideas into the world that some people are going to criticize, is actually what it is to be an artist.
Plus, Jordan Morris ranks what's best in America, somewhat arbitrarily. And I suggest you check out Orson Welles' final masterwork, F for Fake. Or do I? All this week on Bullseye. Let's go. Every week on the show, we are joined by one of our favorite culture critics to recommend some stuff that's worth your time. This week, we're talking about rap music with our friend Andrew Nas from Cocaine Blunts. Hey, Andrew, how's it going?
How's it going, Jesse?
Oh, it's going great. I'm excited about talking about these songs. Let's take a listen to a little bit of Mouse on the Tracks' Get High, Get Loaded, featuring Fiend. 7 in Monte Carlo, Roscoe in my car though. Got grass like a papa, get cash like a auto. Break down cigars, peel sheets, we burn goodies. You burn swishers, be on strong liquor. And notice me stand where I look like a whole magnolia tree. Paint sweet as a donut, clover leaf. Dump the weed, pull the key. Please be able to spot your and know your leaves. Tree funky as a piano that mouth the man handle. Nothing like a high that a volcano can hand you. OG Kush is earwax, last hits. Mouse on the track and Jones, that's classic. This song has an absolutely beautiful beat. It sounds a lot like like a Rap-A-Lot record from the 90s. Like it could have Scarface and Devin the Dude rapping on it.
Well, at the risk of going like deep into rap nerddom here, a lot of the old Rap-A-Lot sound came from a Louisiana producer by the name of N.O. Joe. And he kind of brought that Louisiana funk to Texas for Rap-A-Lot. And it's just always been something that's kind of been there and been around in rap music in New Orleans and Baton Rouge.
Tell me a little bit about what you like particularly about this song.
Well, I mean, it just kind of jams. I like how it reaches back, like I said, the pre-rap history of the area of the Gulf Coast. I like the fact that it's got Fiend, who's an old New Orleans rap veteran from the No Limit days, kind of rapping over the sort of thing he would have rapped on in the late 90s.
Let's get a little bit less mellow and take a listen to basically, I was going to say my favorite song of the year. I'm going to upgrade that to Century. That's how I'm feeling right now. It's a song called Hit Me by Mystical. That was me that you missed. I'm the one you've been missing and wishing for. Listen, all commands will be coming from the goddamn top.
I'm the maestro. I'm the nigga with the niggas.
Oh yeah.
Arrange the direct conductor. Any other broken name you could think of. Hit me. I got drums and shit. Tom Tom. Congos and bongos and guitars and keyboards and cymbals. That's all hot in this. Hit it. Hit it. Hit it. Hit it. Kind of shit you heard on the box and the wow. Even the white people sitting up in his golf, but don't give me do nothing but say wow. You hear that, Helen? He's tearing it up, that fella. I'd love to get my hands on those acapella.
Oh man, I enjoy that very much, Andrew.
I can tell.
I have to say, wow.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the response everybody had when they heard this record. Mystical is one of the great rap energy men. And he's somebody who can sustain that level of energy with, like, absolute precision as a rapper as well, which is a skill that not many dudes have. And he's channeling James Brown, and it's incredible.
He manages the energy of the song exceptionally well. I mean, it's not just turning everything up to 10 and pushing it as hard as you can the whole time. This isn't an Onyx record where somebody's just yelling at you.
No, you're absolutely right.
Let's listen to some more of it. I love this song.
Hit it! I'm getting too old to be calling names. Saying, boy, this is because it's all the same. On top of that, the rapper's always getting all the blame. Is it really because he's looking such an off the chain? Hit it! Chick a pound, pound. Tweet it up, I got something for the round, round. Black man, put your finger for the round on. Put your finger fans up. Man, break it down now.
Andrew Nas is the proprietor of the blog Cocaine Blunts. He also writes regular columns about hip-hop for Pitchfork, The Fader, Hip-Hop Pit Stop, and more. This week, his recommendations, Mystical's Hit Me and Mouse on the Tracks' Get High, Get Loaded, featuring Fiend. Andrew, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest Amy Mann rose to fame fronting the new wave group Till Tuesday. She had on lace gloves with frilly cuffs in the heartrending video for their hit song, 1985's Voices Carry.
In the dark, I'd like to read his mind. But I'm frightened of the things I might find. Oh, there must be something he's thinking.
Since Mann went solo 20 years ago, she's in many ways become the archetypal indie singer-songwriter. She now has 8 acclaimed records under her own name, and her music for the film Magnolia made her an Oscar nominee in 1999. Mann's latest album, Charmer, is in large part about likable people twisting and tearing relationships. Here's the title song.
When you're a charmer, the apples fall.
Man, thanks so much for being on Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, of course. So, as I was listening to that song and a couple of other songs with similar themes on the album, I was thinking about the fact that you have, especially over the last 10 years, aligned yourself personally with the alternative comedy world, which is full of people who are necessarily charming, it being their business, and also are human beings underneath that charm in every positive and negative way.
Well, it's interesting to think about that, because now I'm sort of going over the comics I know and thinking, not all of them are that charming. I think interesting and mesmerizing, but not necessarily super charming. I mean, because as you know, comics are probably even more disturbed and broken than the average musician. So I think it's more likely to find a lack of social skills in the comedy world. I'm sure they're going to be coming after me with their long knives at this. But yeah, you know, there's some nut jobs in amongst the comedy world.
I'm interested in, because of the fact that you have as good a perspective on this as anyone in the world, as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you. The
differences between the social and personal problems of comics and musicians. What are the things that crop up in each group, and how are they different? Because they're both obviously groups of people who had a hard time connecting with the people they wanted to sleep with as a teenager and decided to dedicate themselves to honing a skill that would impress people.
Maybe. I mean, I certainly think that's a subset. It's not the subset I know. That's not in my personal subset, really. It's interesting. I mean, a lot of the musicians I play with are of sort of a musician / nerd subset. You know, the ones that talk for hours about different old keyboards and Moog sounds and pedal bass and fuzz boxes and like just kind of gear nerds. So it's not like I don't really know the kind of rock star dudes who are getting all the ladies kind of people. I don't know. Like the comedy thing to me is just it's bewildering because you are so out there without a net, all on your own. But I think it's like, it's kind of like a doubling down. Like you're absolutely risking ego wise. You're risking it all, but the payoff is really big. When you hit it and everybody's laughing and you're totally killing your, that's probably a bigger payoff because, when I play a song, out of politeness, people are going to clap. Maybe they'll clap a little louder. Maybe maybe they won't. But you're not going to get it's not like an all or nothing proposition like comedy is. So I don't know. It's interesting. I think that's you got to be a certain kind of person who's almost got nothing left to lose to do comedy.
I had never seen the video for the Till Tuesday song that we heard in the introduction, which was your first big hit.
Yeah.
And it is extremely new wave aesthetically.
Yes. the video itself or the song?
The video itself. I mean, the song is to a great extent as well. But the video in particular, I mean, the aforementioned, lace gloves with cuffs.
I love how the detail, you're really paying attention to the detail because I don't remember this at all. I just remember like long gloves, give her some gloves that look like somebody would wear it at an opera.
You look frankly spectacular.
Thank you.
But I wonder if that was something that was part of your identity or whether it was just the aesthetic that was going on and you thought of yourself as a, popular singer, a singer of pop music without the – I'm trying to think of a word that doesn't include the sort of insulting part of that. But, like a popular music singer and the new wave was just the thing that was happening.
Yeah. I mean, it probably was. Like, honestly, it probably it probably was just that it was the thing that was happening, and I kind of got into, I mean, I was like 24, so my bent is more towards, harmony and melody. I mean, I do. That's where I live. It's not so much the stylistic thing. So yeah, that was the new wave thing was just really what was happening. I'm sure if I had grown up in the country rock era, I would be busting out the country rock instead.
Did you have a specific cultural identity? Did you think of yourself as a member of a group of people doing a thing?
No, just like anyone you kind of want to to, you know, like have your look and your sound be like, you know, be commensurate with other looks and sounds that are happening that you think are cool, you know. So I think I was probably, you know, trying to achieve the hair of John Lydon and the, you know, and the sound of, you know, the Thompson Twins or the Cars or something.
What is it like to be 24 years old and have a big hit record?
It did not suit me very well, I have to say. I mean, I think also I was probably like a very young 24 in that, you know, I sort of look at people like Taylor Swift or Katy Perry who are, I mean, they're in their early 20s still, right? And I'm like, not in a million years could I handle that. Anything about that situation, you know, talking on talk shows and playing giant show, you know, arena shows and awards shows and red carpets. Like, I'm not in a million years could I. I mean, that's like a whole, it's like 80 different skill sets that I like it are totally beyond me. You know, we came Till Tuesday's, you know, Big Hit Voices Carry was kind of right in the beginning of MTV. And, you know, that was such a novelty that, you know, people, we became really recognizable very, very quickly. And, you know, people following me back to my $400 a month apartment, you know, in the middle of the day was just, I mean, I just found it threatening and creepy. You know, it's hard to feel, I think unless you're a giant narcissist, it's hard to like really enjoy that. It just seems like, I don't know how to handle this. I don't know what to say to people. You know, if people say like, I love you, you're so great. You're like, thank you. I don't have anything to say past thank you. And also, I don't know, it was very strange because we were very recognizable, but we had no money, zero money. We were living on $150 a week. And we were opening for this tour for Hall & Oates, who were huge at the time. They were playing arenas. We were driving around in a van and sleeping two to a room in Motel 6. And it was, you know, like a just this really weird, disparate, you know, on the one hand being regarded as kind of like a TV glamorous thing. And on the other hand, just being completely broke.
Did you feel like part of the issue was that there was sort of pressure associated with being a TV glamorous thing, that like you had to represent this band and the idea of being a rock star and you had to be good at it when you hadn't had any practice?
Yeah, and I was terrible at it. I mean, I'm absolutely not formulated for that at all. I'm not, you know, a lot of the stuff that comes along with that is record companies kind of having the expectation that you're going to do a lot of sort of like kind of ancillary promo stuff for them and visit radio stations and glad hand people. And man, I didn't know how to, you know, I mean, that was just not in my wheelhouse whatsoever. Yeah, it's, and keeping up this sort of front and, you know, and I did have like a lot of people saying from the record company or management or whatever, like, you know, trying to give me instructions how to, you know, like, you got to get on that stage and own it, you know, like make your gestures bigger. Like, I'm not a big gesture person. I don't know what that, I'm not that person who's like, I have to make everyone in this place love me, all 10,000 of you. I'm more like, here it is. I hope you like it. If not, then cool. Somebody else will be along shortly. And then, you know, for a second record, I started writing songs. I had been writing songs on the bass, which because we were doing this kind of, you know, like semi dance pop stuff. And then I started writing songs on acoustic guitar. And I immediately just felt like this is so much more my thing. It's just it feels smaller. It feels more intimate. It's more about the song. It's less about, you know, this kind of spectacle or sound or presentation.
Do you remember a particular song that you wrote that felt different to you that you were really happy with?
Yeah, it was probably one of the first songs that I wrote on acoustic guitar was this song called Coming Up Close that was on our second record. It was just, you know, totally different. I mean, it was a real acoustic guitar-based kind of thing. And it was totally different, you know. And, of course, the record company was like, no, we want more Duran Duran-y stuff.
Did they actually say that to you in those words?
No, but I mean, they wanted a record that sounded like the last record.
The night and I, well, he and I in a borrowed car, went driving in the summer, promises and every star. Out in the distance I could hear some people laughing. I felt my heart beat back, a weekend's worth of sadness. There was a farmhouse that had long since been deserted. We stopped and carved our hearts into the wooden surface. We thought just for an instant we could see the future. We thought for once we knew what really was important.
That was Coming Up Close by the band Till Tuesday. My guest Amy Mann was their lead singer. You ended up in this multi-directional major record label disaster show with around the time of your, I guess, the third Till Tuesday album, which was... you know, you had, maybe you can, you're probably will do a better job of I than of describing this sort of 10-car pileup of record contracts and.
Well, it's such a mess. It's hard to know how to nutshell it. And I don't want to really like super bore anyone with, you know, details of like my contractual junk. So Till Tuesday had the first record was a big hit. The second record, I think, like, did okay, but its sound was really different, and I don't think they knew what to do with it. And so the third record, by the time the third record came out, the keyboard player and the guitar player had both left to do other things. And a bunch of new people came into the label, and this is, like, a real classic thing where, you know, the new A&R guy is like, well, we just want to make sure that you're, like, cool with writing with other people. And what that means is, like, will you write with the sort of Hollywood, you know, hit doctors, which Katy Perry, like, all those people do now. If you hear any hits on the radio, it's the, quote, co-writes with these people, you know, whoever happens to be top of the heap. And, you know, me naively, I'm like, yeah, sure. I mean, I just wrote a song with Elvis Costello. And they're like, oh, that's not what we're talking about. and then they were like, well, your contract is up for renewal and we're not sure we're going to renew it. And the record has just been released, like, you know, 2 weeks before. So, you know, we just think that you should go back in the studio and make another record. And I'm like, well, I just made one. It's pretty fresh, two weeks old. And, like, they clearly just wanted, you know, they wanted to have, like, a controllable, formulaic, you know, situation. You know, I was like, well, if you clearly, like, don't like what I'm doing, so why don't we just go our separate ways? And they said, well, we'd release you from your contract, but we're afraid you're going to go to another label and have a hit. So they wouldn't release me from my contract for 3 years. And I think at that point they thought, oh, her career is definitely over, so we could get rid of her now.
I read somewhere you describing yourself being so distraught in this period of time that you not only were upset with the record labels, but upset with the situation, the sort of catch-22 situation, to such an extent that you couldn't even just enjoy music, generally speaking.
Yeah, you know, I think it gets to, God, you know, like it's great to think that you can not be affected by that, and I always think that I'm not going to be affected by other people's outside opinions, but you know, when they're the only people listening to your stuff and commenting, you start to just feel like a loser. You know, like everything I do is just not good enough. You know, every song that I've played is like, eh. So then I go, all right, I'm Ant. Like, I accept it. I accept that I'm Ant. You have now convinced me. So everything I write now, as I'm writing it, I go, hey, why finish it? Because nobody cares. And of course, it's a false, you know, I mean, people do care, but they're not getting to hear the music. You know, they're not the people who, they're not, these guys are hearing the music, not somebody who actually might enjoy it.
You had a great song a couple records ago about turning 31. And a lot of this stuff was happening as you were in that sort of part of your life.
31 today. What a thing to say. Drinking dinners in the afternoon. Taking shelter.
It's funny because I didn't really, like, that really was, when I was 31, that really was when all this stuff was happening. And, you know, like, yeah, I think that probably did pile it on. You know, I was writing that song out of just the memory of, you know, like, when you're a kid and you think, like, oh, when I'm in my 30s, like, my life's going to be set. You know, I'm going to be grown up and, you know, things are going to be up and running, and there's not going to be question marks. So to kind of reach this age and go, wow, it's all question marks. It's nothing but question marks.
After a break, more with Amy Mann. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. You can follow Bullseye on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/Bullseye with Jesse Thorne and click like. It's Bullseye, I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the singer-songwriter Amy Mann. Her latest album is called Charmer. I want to take a listen to a little bit of Save Me from the Magnolia soundtrack, a song that was, among other things, got you nominated for an Oscar.
You look like a perfect fit.
How is it different to experience the fame and success that you had from the songs that you had on the Magnolia soundtrack and the album that you had out at that time than when you were in your early 20s 15 years earlier?
Well, you know, the success of Till Tuesday, I felt was like a promise I couldn't keep. And the promise was that we're a big commercial band, and I was like, I just always felt like I could not deliver on this promise. And you know, performance wise, I mean, playing live, you know, and that was very difficult. I did not know how to make that happen. It was, you know, singing was not easy. I don't think my voice is that great, and it was, you know, I certainly didn't think it was very good then. And you know, so it was just all, and I just always felt like I was coming short, you know, was not hitting the mark. And with Magnolia, I felt like that was, you know, my best work. I thought Save Me was one of my best songs. So it really was, you know, more, I felt putting my best foot forward and felt very, like, a lot more solid about it.
Before the Oscars, you made a joke somewhere about Phil Collins was also nominated. He ended up winning that year for something that he wrote for the film Tarzan.
Yeah.
Fondly remembered film Tarzan. And I think
the cartoon always wins.
Yeah. You made a joke about, like, booing Phil Collins that I heard that actually led to Phil Collins like looking into the situation personally.
I can't remember exactly what happened, but I think he like said, yeah, I think his people called. It was something like that. Like, yeah. And then I was like, dude, it's a joke. Everybody wants to see someday, like, see somebody like get really upset that they didn't win. I mean, that was just a funny, you know, I thought that would be hilarious. And I thought, look, here's the opportunity. I can be that person. But of course, I couldn't.
I
too nice.
Like you, at least at the time, I'm not personally a huge Phil Collins fan, but which is not to say I have anything against Phil Collins, in no small part because we had him on the show one time. He was just a wonderful man. Just
I hear he's very sweet.
Couldn't have been a more pleasant, funny, interesting guy. And I wonder if you ever had a face-to-face meeting with him.
I think I saw him in the halls at the Oscar. I'm pretty sure I did. I think we passed each other and it was like, oh, sorry about the thing or what, you know. Yeah, I think there was like a very brief detente. Yeah, I'm sure I've heard he's very nice. And he's got songs that I like. You know, like I'm not anti-Phil Collins by, look, Susudio. Okay. We all have our dark skeletons in our closets. But... Look, God, you know, God bless him. I have nothing against him.
How is your songwriting different now that you are an experienced hand, so to speak, both in terms of your process and in terms of the product?
I mean, really the short answer, and this doesn't mean anything to anybody, but I feel that I'm better according to the standards that are my own, you know, and a lot of it is trying to refine a lot. Probably most of it is trying to refine the lyric writing process, like having rhymes be perfect rhymes, if possible. But it doesn't take much for me to go like, you know what, it's not going to get any better. Like, let it go. I mean, I do sort of think like good enough is good enough, but I do try to have, you know, perfect rhymes and internal rhymes and the meter to be really locked in, because I just feel like on a real visceral level, it's very fun for people to hear that, you know, to hear rhymes that are exact and hear these kind of internal things and, like, you know, have the meter be really locked in from verse to verse. But that's all like the bar that I, you know, I enjoy when other people like meet that bar, which is probably like Stephen Sondheim and nobody else.
Let's hear another song from your new album, Charmer. This song is called Labrador by my guest, Amy Mann.
Daisy, you shouldn't do the things you do, but you're just so incapable of changing. You lie so well. I could never even tell what were facts in your artful rearranging.
So I guess the question that occurred to me as I was listening to this song suite of songs about destructive narcissism was, what are you doing here in Los Angeles, the home of destructive narcissism?
Yeah. Well, you know, a series of accidents. Believe me, narcissism is all around us. It's everywhere. You know, although it's the industry, it's like the industry of this town is built on making things appear to be different than they are, which is kind of the soul of narcissism, right? You know, being more concerned about how things look than how things are. But at least in this industry, people are aware of how things are because they're seeing it, you know, on the set every day. Like they're not really, almost like the people in the industry are less fooled by the appearance than other people, except for maybe actors. Actors are pretty crazy. But you have to admit, not all of them.
I could almost shed a tear, but let's shine in the time we have remaining. You're tough, old gal, but a dog is just a pal. And believe me, my dear, I'm not complaining. So
I want to hear one more song from your new record. It's called Crazy Town.
I guess this movie must have opened wide. Another girl who threatened suicide. You called the cops, but then she denied every word. And you know you'll be the one who's paying the tab for her.
Before you go, I want to ask you about boxing. This has been a hobby of yours for a while. You do not have a boxer's build.
Well, not a heavyweight. I think at this point, I am probably a flyweight. I do not weigh a lot, and as you can see, there's not a lot of muscle on me.
I had a teacher in middle school who was a flyweight. He was like 5'1". And he was just a human muscle, like a tight, like a skinny human. Like all there was there was just going, thrip, thrip, thrip. You know what I mean?
Well, there's some boxers, you know, like I got the reach, so I have the jab, and that's not too bad. But I'm not in the ring. I'm not going round and round with anyone.
Have you gotten punched in the face?
Yes.
I'm afraid to be punched in the face. What was it like to be punched in the face?
It's, boxing is very interesting in my experience. Now, I don't really do it anymore for a variety of reasons, mostly because I can't wear contacts anymore. So, you know, you're not doing a lot of boxing in glasses. But I did do some sparring. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I weirdly equate it with some of the lessons I learned with performing, because a lot of it is, you know, you get hit and you have to go, you know what, move on. Like you can't get mad because that throws you off your game and your strategy. You just have to keep going forward. And I remember that. Like I think about that all the time when I'm on stage. If I make a mistake or I forget something, I'm like, move on, it's over. Just keep going forward. You know, because you got to finish it out.
Amy Mann's newest record is called Charmer.
But there's slime crawling back up from the ocean. You can't keep everyone at bay. Starts with an accident or failure. It all starts with a great big bang. And guess who's gonna have to play the jailer? And guess who's gonna lead the chain gang? Gamma Ray. Gamma
Ray. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. this topsy-turvy world, only one man can bring order to the thousands, nay, millions, of things that exist. With his signature segment, Jordan Ranks America, here's Jordan Morris.
Entering the chart at number 5 this month, it's 19-year-olds. Wow, 19-year-olds. Your explanation for why you're not religious anymore was so beautiful, so eloquent, I feel like it could have been plucked out of a best-selling novel. Holding fast at number 4, it's Smash Mouth. It may seem like this mid-90s party rock band has been laying low as of late, but every time someone watches a Shrek movie on cable, they hear 30 seconds of a Smash Mouth song, a proverbial masterclass in staying relevant. Still in the mix at number 3, it's Man Caves. Do actual men really hang out in the basement watching sports and playing Xbox away from their wives? Or is Man Cave just a buzzword invented by marketing companies to sell fast food and beer? There's literally no way to know unless our elected officials get off their lazy duffs and do their job. Coming out of nowhere at number 2, it's Your Girlfriend's Friend from Work. She's a little quiet and seems to have emotional problems, but she and your GF sure do seem to enjoy their inside jokes. Leading the pack at number 1, it's bananas. Grab one for a breakfast on the go, throw it into a smoothie, or hold it up to your ear and pretend it's a telephone. Is there anything these jungle wonder fruits can't do? From the bottom to the top, I'm Jordan Morris.
Jordan Morris co-hosts the podcast Jordan, Jesse, Go! With me, Jesse. He also stars in the web series Game Shop. You can find it at youtube.com/start. After a break, I'll talk with marketing guru Seth Godin about putting art into the world that markets itself. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. Production of Bullseye is supported in part by MailChimp. With email newsletters and social media integration, MailChimp is like your own personal publishing platform.
To my blessed old brother David, happy birthday. Love, Lisa.
Online at MailChimp.com. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Our show's about art, or at least culture, and the people who make it. I never thought I'd invite onto our show a guy who most people know as a marketing guru. My guest Seth Godin is a marketing guru, but he's a different kind of one. In best-selling books like The Purple Cow, Tribes, and Lynchpin, he's focused on creating products that market themselves, work that's honest and remarkable, and work that honors customers, whether the customers are folks using software, people buying widgets, or people listening to music. He has three, count them, three new books out. V for Vulnerable is a picture book for adults about doing scary creative work. The Icarus Deception is about the same thing, how to make something authentic and vibrant outside of your comfort zone. What You're Going to Do with That Duck is 600 pages of Godin's writing for his blog, one of the most popular business blogs in the world. Seth Godin, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Well, it's one of my life's dreams to be on the show with you. So thank you, Jesse. I'm a big fan.
I wish that was more people's life's dream. I could be like Derek Jeter visiting sick children and inviting them on my radio show.
There you go. I mean, I guess if I had giant dreams, then they wouldn't come true. But this one was attainable, and I'm thrilled I pulled it off.
Okay, so here's my first question. I hope you won't think it rude, but I think I alluded to the fact in the introduction to this segment that in my mind, sort of in the abstract, marketing guru is pretty much the worst thing you can be, because I think of marketing as being a trick and like one of the only parts of capitalism that I'm not quite on board with. And I wonder if you ever thought about that as you found yourself becoming a marketing expert, and how you worked it over in your mind.
Well, I'm completely down with you and in agreement about most marketing. I'm not sure I agree on the capitalist thing, like dumping PCBs in the Hudson is also not high on my list. Here's the thing. It's the sea monkeys' fault. Now, you may remember sea monkeys from the comic books when we were growing up. And what happened was what often happened with marketing, which is some industrialist, some guy with a company, has an average product for average people, pretty junky. He gives it to the marketer along with some money and says, put on a show, put on a wrapper, trick some people into buying this thing. So if you ever bought Sea Monkeys, you know that what you really got was a little tiny packet of invisible, mostly dead brine shrimp. And you were bitter. That was $1.99 of hard-earned newspaper money, and here you'd been tricked. This started to shift a little while ago when marketing and advertising stopped being the same thing. So in the days of Mad Men, your marketing budget and your ad budget were the same thing. But now what a new breed of marketers is discovering is that you're better off spending the money doing something brave and spending the money making a product or a service that people actually want to talk about, because it's too hard to fool all the people all the time.
I want to ask you, too, about the guru part of it, which is to say, there was a really lovely, touching post on your blog a couple of months ago when Zig Ziglar died. And, you know, he is as archetypal a business guru as ever there could be. I mean, a man that, you know, traveled the world inspiring, you know, Lions clubs to CEOs to achieve their dreams and close their deals and think positively and all these things. What was your relationship to that world and specifically to Ziglar?
I miss him. For 7 years, I was near bankruptcy. For 7 years, I was getting rejected from everything I pitched, and most projects I touched turned to dust. And there was a lot of pressure, family and otherwise, for me to give it up and become a bank teller. And I bought the Zig Ziglar cassette tapes and listened to them in my car for literally thousands of hours until I basically memorized them.
Well, what's on them? I mean, I've never heard them.
Well, you know, Zig grew up in Yazoo City, Mississippi, and is a storyteller, or was, and came from the lineage of sort of Baptist preachers. Most of his best work was him telling stories about selling pots and pans door to door, or Johnny the Shoeshine Guy in St. Louis, or stories about his best friend whose son had a form of muscular dystrophy. Some of the stories would last 10, 15, 20 minutes. And what you learned from these stories was the benefit of feeding your mind, of understanding that you could help other people at the same time that you were delivering something of value. It wasn't about manipulation as much as it was about understanding that you had some choices to make about what attributes and skills you developed and what you were going to bring to the world around you. Now, some people, and this is where I think the guru thing, a mantle I wear sort of as a joke, got a bad name, is that some people would hear this sort of advice and use it to indulge their selfish nature and to manipulate other people. And some people would use the ability to sound like a guru to maximize their income and their profit. And it becomes a caricature, something a role Tom Cruise can play in a movie. So that if you put too many burning embers in the middle of your seminar, it starts to be all fluff and no substance. I think the key distinctions are, one, are you doing it to generate something for yourself, or are you doing it to help the people you're teaching? And two, are you giving people a map or a compass? And I work very hard to be in the compass business.
When you were failing and you found Zig Ziglar tapes and listened to them in your car until they wore out, what changed about you or your life?
Well, you know, it's so easy to caricature Zig. He talked about go lights instead of stoplights and other sort of, you know, juvenile touchstones. But what changed for me, the biggest thing that changed for me, is that every no became a no for now. Every no became one step closer to a yes from somebody else. Every failure became a lesson that taught me one more thing that isn't going to work. So I stopped saying, how do I please this person right this minute across the table so I can make a sale? And I shifted to, what am I trying to do here in the first place? What's the dent I'm trying to make in the universe? And if this person doesn't get the joke, that's okay. Maybe they'll teach me something that will help me tell the story to the next person so they will get the joke. But that what I shouldn't do is compromise the principle and the mission just to make a sale today. And that was before the internet. Today it's even more important because you leave a trail today for all to see. And so when you compromise and pander and jump in with the pack, we can see it a month later and a year later, and you can't deny it. And so the folks that we're highlighting today and that we're following today and that we're engaging with, the records that we buy or the movies we see, tend to be made by people who are authentic. I mean, I thought your interview with Judd Apatow was brilliant, and part of it was that what you heard from him is that he's been making the same movie from the beginning, which is an honest movie that he wants to talk about, something that's happened to him, as opposed to him focus grouping and corporatizing what he does to figure out how to get the maximum box office.
There's this part in your book, The Icarus Deception, where you describe these, you call them the assets that matter. And they're things that I recognize as in some ways, you know, the core values that you've been pushing in your blog and in your writing and your work for years. And, you know, to some extent you've added to them, made a fuller picture, tackled one at a time, but it feels almost like a manifesto. I wonder if we could talk about those for a second.
Sure. Go ahead and tee them up because I don't have the list right in front of me.
Yeah, sure. The first of them is, and this is something that you describe as being key to successful organizations, freelancers, and soloists, which basically means anybody that makes anything in 2012 in the first world. The first of them is trust. What does that mean?
Well, if you're going to go buy toothpaste or you're going to go to a chiropractor or your business is going to hire an accountant, you can't kick the tires. You have to believe at some point and make a leap. And so when we enter the marketplace, some organizations are saying, my goal is to build trust. Everything I do is to support that single mission. How do I build more trust? So that's what I'm trying to do, for example, on my blog. My blog has no ads. I don't sell anything. But what I'm trying to do is earn the trust of more people, because with trust, you can accomplish a lot more.
That's very deeply related to the second asset, which is permission. And that was the subject of your first big book, Permission Marketing. What does permission mean in this context?
Well, so let's think about it from the point of view, for example, of a podcast. In the old days, there were only five radio stations that mattered in any given town. So if someone was going to listen to the radio, they were probably going to pick you. But in a world where there's 10,000 podcasts to choose from, the only ones that have any impact are ones that people have elected to listen to. So this permission, the privilege of people listening to you, is something that you earn. You can't buy it. And so all the big brands that are struggling are discovering they can't buy any more TV ads. They can't get any more newspaper ads that pay for themselves. All that's left is to earn this privilege of whispering to people when you have something to say to them. And hence, we see, you know, people lining up to buy the next thing from Apple Computer that no one has ever used before. The reason they even know about it is because they have given Apple permission to whisper to them in the form of an announcement, it's ready. And all they have to do is say it's ready, and all these people run to go get it. Now, this is not an accident. This is something you build. It's something you earn. You earn it by making stuff that along the way was eccentric enough that it failed, that along the way was interesting enough that I want to know what the next one is. So if all you're going to do is make average stuff for average people, I'm not going to give you my permission. But if you are in my corner, always on the cutting edge, cutting that new record or telling that new joke or doing that new kind of art in a way that I would miss it if it was gone, then I am more likely to give you my permission to tell me about the next one.
I thought it was really interesting that you included eccentric enough to fail in an interesting way in that list of qualities, because the thing that worries me is that people in an effort to build those two qualities that we've talked about so far, trust and permission, want to essentially play it safe so they don't mess up and don't disappoint people.
Exactly. And they do it because they're afraid to take responsibility for doing the thing that people didn't like. But trust is not about always doing it right. Trust is about what you do if it doesn't work. That's how we build trust, right? We don't trust an airline because they always get us there without killing us. We trust an airline because when things mess up, they make it right. And so we earn this privilege of getting attention first. We get attention because we're interesting. And then we get trust because we tell the truth and we keep our promises. And so the Wright brothers were wrong and they were wrong and they were wrong and they were wrong, and then one day they were right. But they would never have gotten to right, no pun intended, if they hadn't been wrong all those times before. And the same thing is true with Elvis Costello, and the same thing is true with Kurt Vonnegut. So when you decide to trod the path of the artist, you are not saying, I will always be perfect. You're saying, I will always be interesting.
It seems to me like part of the difference between two things that you've described. One is doing something interesting and failing, and the other is just putting something out and saying, if you don't like it, you can return it. You know, only one of those has a guarantee. It's the second one. But only one of those is driven by values that people can recognize, which is the first one.
Right. It's about being human. We're exiting an era of 100 years of being corporate and saying, you pay your money, you take your chances. This is cheaper than the other guy. We have a big box store. And we are re-entering this era of being human, of Kickstarter and podcasts and people who are doing machine-aided design, sending something overseas. Who knows who makes it, right? You're not buying it from the person who made it. You're buying from the person who designed it, who told you the story about it, who connected you to it. And the important distinction to make here, Jesse, which is really important, is most of us were raised to believe that art was something that was made by other people. That's a magical art lightning bolt hit Pablo Picasso when he was little, and he gets to be an artist and we don't. And in fact, it's just not true that we have been brainwashed into thinking that we are cogs in a corporate machine. But given the chance, human beings are capable of being human. And it doesn't have to be art with a paintbrush or art with a stand-up comedian's microphone. It can be the art of customer service and the art of delivering healthcare. That when we act like a human, other humans respond with trust and permission. But when we act like a corporation, we're held to a totally different standard, and people just want to know, is it cheap and can I get my money back?
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Seth Godin. Most people know him as a marketing guru, but he's sort of a different kind of marketing guru. Mainly, he's not super creepy. He has three new books out, V for Vulnerable, The Icarus Deception, and What You Gonna Do With That Duck. One of the six values or the six assets that matter is humanity, which I think is partly what you've been describing. You describe that as connection, compassion, and humility. I don't think that humility is a quality that we often associate with successful business or even successful creators. Why did you include humility?
Well, you know, in talking to people like Elizabeth Gilbert and others who have touched others, what I hear from them is that they're okay with the expression, this might not work. that to go to a meeting at a corporation and say, I'd love to do this, but it might not work, is a very difficult thing to say. Because MBAs are taught to always say, here's spreadsheets, I have proof, it will work. But in Silicon Valley, they say this might not work all the time. And at Columbia Records during its heyday was all about this might not work. YouTube is this farm team of stuff that might not work, right? Korean pop. It's never worked before. Why is it going to work this time? I don't know. It might not work. But the price, the cost of bringing this to the market keeps going down.
One of the six assets is leadership, which, I mean, you make some interesting distinctions in discussing leadership. One of them is that most leaders' jobs historically has been to essentially replicate and refine the work that went before them. And that is no longer in outside of, you know, the classic industrialized mechanized economy. You know, that's sort of a 20th century value.
Yeah, no one talks about the fact that they have leaders at the local McDonald's. They have managers because the manager's job is to get the team to do what they did yesterday, but a little faster, a little cheaper, and a little bit more reliably. Management is something we've figured out pretty well. But leadership is about these leaps in the dark and about being willing to go forward, creating a vacuum behind you so that people will follow you. And the great leaders in politics and business and mathematics and music are all doing something that while they're doing it, many people around them are saying they're crazy. And they are crazy because they're doing something that might not work. But once they do it and it works, then the vacuum behind them sucks the people along and they move forward. What happens now that everyone owns a media channel, that everyone can broadcast where they want to go and what they want to do and what they want to make, is that you don't need a building or a permit or a badge to be a leader now. You can just lead. Here's a microphone. If you want to sing, sing. If you want to dance, dance. If you want to make a video, make a video. So when a filmmaker starts today, if Steven Spielberg were starting today, the answer would not be to lie his way onto the Universal lot and figure out how to get under someone's tutelage. The answer would be go get yourself a $149 camera and make a damn movie and put it on the internet and see what happens. And if it's not right, then make a different one, a better one. That if our art doesn't work, our job is to make better art.
There are two assets in your list of six assets that we haven't talked about yet. And they're, I think, two that are very deeply linked. The first is remarkability. What does remarkability mean? Is that a word you made up? Is that a real word even?
I make up a lot of words, but I had to quit playing that letterpress app on my phone because I was spending too much time on it. So I don't know if remarkability is a real word or not. But what it means is simple. You used to be able to buy attention. Now you can't. Attention spreads from one person to another. It spreads when one person remarks about your work. So if someone leaves the movie theater and tells three other people how great your movie is, you're on. It's going to work, right? And so it doesn't have to be good. It has to be remarkable in the sense that I care enough about what you made that I want other people to see it.
And the other one is stories that spread, which is very deeply connected to remarkability, I think. What is the quality of a story that makes it something that someone wants to tell someone else?
Well, let's be clear about what I mean by a story. So Little Red Riding Hood is a story in the sense that it has a middle and an end and a beginning. But the stories I'm talking about are a little bit more metaphorical than that. So that when Susan Cain spoke at TED about shyness versus extroverts, the story, the inherent story in that is that it's okay to not be the garrulous extrovert all the time, that teams can benefit from the more introspective person. So that's my, you know, summary of what she said over 18 minutes. But it stuck in my head. I mean, I've seen 1,000 TED Talks, but that one stuck in my head because that story, that truth, the nugget of it, resonates with me. And it's more likely, if I'm going to talk about what I saw at TED, that A, I will talk about her talk because it was remarkable, and B, the story of it is one that can be encapsulated and spread to the next person.
There's this thing that you write a lot about in the new book, The Icarus Deception, which is kind of the opposite of what I think people go to gurus to learn about.
And good.
It's and it's something that I learned from my friend Merlin Mann, who had this very, very, very popular blog, and realized that he kind of felt like people were going to it for what you described earlier as a map, and that he wasn't really giving them what he felt like was actually useful to them, and so he had to just sort of stop doing that, despite the fact that he had been very successful at it. And you write a lot in this book about the fact that doing this kind of thing, that whatever, being presumptive enough to try doing something in a completely different way, being creative in general, is typically painful. That people want to come to you for a way to do, for a map to do something relatively painlessly, to do something new in a way that has already been proven. But basically what you're telling them is you're just going to have to wade into the thorn bush.
Yeah.
That's, that's a weird thing for a guru to sell, Seth.
Well, but I don't have anything to sell, Jesse. That's the key benefit of the way I've constructed my career, is I don't do any coaching. I don't do any consulting. I have no add-on products to sell. The blog is free. The audios are free. The videos are free, because I'm not here to sell you something. I'm here to make you uncomfortable. And if it's too uncomfortable, you'll leave, and that's okay with me because you don't get the joke. I am so fortunate that I get to do this thing, that I get to make my art. And the same way that it's okay for a painter to have you not get his painting, or Gary Larson to have you not get the joke of the Far Side cartoon today, it's okay with me if you're not up for the pain. What drives me is this. I gave a talk to a bunch of educators, and in the Q&A, a woman stood up. She said, I help run a community college, and all this leadership and art stuff is fine for other people. But what you don't understand, Seth, is that we have to let in everybody. And the people we let in, these people, they're not artists. These people will never make a difference. These people aren't capable of doing the kind of leadership that you are describing. And I literally shed a tear right there on the stage, because I couldn't believe this woman who had been trusted by so many thousands of people and the taxpayers had this idea that art was for other people, but that her people, people who looked the way they did, had no right to it. And yeah, it's super painful, but it's not expensive, and it's not based on where you grew up. That what we did that's so incredibly empowering is that anybody who's got a Wi-Fi connection has access to a market of a billion people who might want to listen to them. And if people start listening to you and trusting you, then as painful as it is, you can start changing things, and you can start changing the conversation. And inevitably, if you are good at that, you will be able to make a living at it. You know, maybe not a Steven Spielberg size living, but a living. I've never, ever met anyone who said, too many people trust me, too many people know my ideas, I'm having trouble making a living.
So what do you do when it's painful?
That's the compass. That's the signal that you're on to something. That if I'm busy writing and I'm saying, yeah, 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 this one's, I'm in, then I've written banal pap, right? If I'm writing and I'm realizing as I'm writing that a third of my audience is going to give up, or that a quarter of them are going to slam the book, or that I'm going to get someone who misunderstood what I just said, then I know I'm onto something. That our job as artists is to find the edge between complete non-acceptance and applause. It's right in that zone that we get to do something that's interesting.
Seth, what do you do when you have an idea that's a really good idea, like a really solid idea, but you can't come up with an appropriate illustrative narrative. Because you are super good at illustrative narratives. I'm in awe of the volume of illustrative narratives that you're capable of generating.
Well, you totally stopped me with that one. I think the question that I ask myself all the time is, who is this story for? That you tell a different story to a venture capitalist than you tell to an 18-year-old music student. And you want that story to resonate with the worldview they already have. Because changing someone's worldview is difficult and time-consuming and usually fails. But hooking into a worldview they already have, saying, you believe this and this leverages into that, is the way you start change to happen. And what I do for a living, my son likes to point out I'm unemployed. What I do for a living is I notice things. And what I'm always looking for is, what about this success or this failure, what about it hooks in to what other people already believe? So how can I describe it to them so they can see what I'm seeing?
Well, Sats, we've been talking for quite a long time, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. And honestly, for taking the time to make the world of business a little less creepy.
Well, we're working every day, Jesse, to make it less creepier still. I will keep up the good work if you will too.
If you want to read Seth Godin's blog, you can just type into the internet Seth's blog. It works. I've done it myself. His three new books are The Icarus Deception, V is for Vulnerable, and What You Gonna Do with That Duck? Every week on Bullseye, we close the show with a recommendation from yours truly. It's The Outshot. There's a great story about P.T. Barnum, and as with most great stories, I'm not entirely certain it's true. Barnum's museums were full of what you might charitably call hokum, or bunk. A classic example, the Fiji mermaid, which was a monkey sewed to a fish. The honest truth, of course, is that at the time, the whole idea of establishing truth, concrete scientific truth, was pretty new. So anyway, the story is that in Barnum's museum, there was a series of signs that said, this way to the egress, and the paying guests would follow the signs. The first sign, the second, the third, wondering, what is an egress? Until eventually, the last sign dumped them completely without ceremony onto the street outside the museum. So as it turns out, that series of signs was one of the few things in Barnum's world that wasn't a trick. Because egress, if you don't know, is just a fancy word for exit. And so the people would be kind of miffed, and then they'd laugh, and then they'd pay again to get back in. The question this story suggests to me, at least, is, when we pay to get in, are we paying for truth or are we paying for a great story? Orson Welles, a showman like few others, understood the consequences of bunk and hokum and fiction implicitly. One of his greatest works, The War of the Worlds, was, of course, a hoax. His greatest, Citizen Kane, was a fiction built to represent a truth, the life of a real man, as imagined by Welles. That's probably why his last masterwork, F for Fake, is so confounding and hilarious and fascinating.
Behold, before our very eyes, a transformation.
It's a sort of documentary, or maybe a film essay. It's about a great art forger, Elmir de Hory.
If you hang them in a museum in a collection of great paintings, and if they hang long enough there, they become real.
And about his biographer, Clifford Irving.
The important distinction to make when you're talking about the genuine quality of a painting is not so much whether it's a real painting or a fake. It's whether it's a good fake or a bad fake.
Irving, if you don't know, also wrote the autobiography of Howard Hughes. He sold it for $750,000 to a publisher. A few months later, the public and the publisher discovered that Irving had never met Hughes in his life. It was a hoax. When it was revealed that he was a liar, Irving wrote another book about how he tricked the world.
Can you say anything about the deal that you've managed to do with the book? I mean, has it turned out as well as you'd expected?
The deal?
Are you going to tell the whole truth?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, the title is the book about the book. In 2 years,
Wells' introduction comes with a magic trick and an actress, Wells' partner, Oya Koder, and a few sneaky shots of his camera crew at work. And it ends in a bit of editing chicanery that mirrors the sleight of hand Wells performed at the start. Wells is telling a story, and he reminds us that he's in charge, but also that he's not above the occasional trick. I'd say it's Brechtian, except that in showing us the workings of theater, Brecht was trying to reveal the tricks of fiction to get us viewers to confront fact. In making F for fake, Wells wants to sort of dance in the middle ground. But the good news is, it is a wonderful, charming dance.
Almost any story is almost certainly some kind of lie. But not this time. No, this is a promise. During the next hour, everything you'll hear from us is really true and based on solid facts.
As Wells narrates from his editing booth, we see these stories play out before us. Elmir, the forger, asking us to confront our ideas about the nature of art. Irving, the expert writer, revealed as a charlatan himself. Wells admitting his own charlatanism. As a director and editor, using that moviola in front of him to cut and transform the filmic document. It's an argument against the Academy, that force which Barnum was discovering and impersonating in the 19th century, which by the 20th century had consolidated its power and codified its methods.
Cliff Irving's caper may well be the hoax of the century, but really this is not, you know, in any way the century of the hoax. We hanky-panky men have always been with you.
That's a fact.
What's new are they?
The experts.
The experts.
The so-called experts.
Experts are the new oracles.
Who are greatly pretentious.
They speak to us with the absolute authority of the computer.
Pretend to know something what they only know very superficially.
And we bow down before them. They're God's own gift to the faker.
All the world loves to see the experts and the establishment made a fool of.
And all this interrogation and feinting and disguise and illusion builds to a third act so sly and surprising and funny that I won't reveal it here. I'd never pull a trick like that on you.
Picasso himself said it. Art, he said, is a lie. A lie that makes us realize the truth.
That's my outshot. That's it for this week's Bullseye. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Our senior producer, Nick White. Our intern, Lindsay Pavlis. Our interstitial music provided by Dan Wally. Thanks this week to Jason Isaac at WNYC for engineering help with our Seth Godin interview. Look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud, where you can share your favorite segments with your friends. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR. On this week's episode of Wildcard, actor Chris Pine tells us it's okay not to be perfect.
My film got absolutely decimated when it premiered, which brings up for me one of my primary triggers or whatever is like not being liked.
I'm Rachel Martin. Chris Pine on how to find joy in imperfection. That's on NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, the game where cards control the conversation.
Do you wish stories could unfold over 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? You tired of doom scrolling, trying to find humanity? Or maybe a deeper understanding of why the world is the way it is? Listen to Embedded, NPR's original documentary series. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.